to really humanize the concept of IT within enterprise software. But when it comes to the bringing the human perspective to computing, this is something that Alan has been doing all his life, using computing as a personal medium to amplify human creativity. So without further ado, Alan Kay.
So thank you very much. And yes, the reason I'm standing up here is because of my friend and colleague Dan Ingalls. Dan, stand up and... So this is kind of a design talk, I think. And I gave a talk with some of the same themes for SAP about 6 months ago. I think it was a customer-centered talk, mostly CIOs and some CTOs of customer companies in the audience. That talk is on YouTube. I looked at it the other day to try and avoid saying too many of the same things the same way. And reason for that is, as Sam pointed out, a change in perspective can be worth a lot of IQ points, and it can also be worth negative IQ points. So you can get into areas that are fruitful. You can start trying to think your way out of a situation where you don't have the materials and the operations to help. So I'll just put this up. I was trying to figure out what talk can I give that isn't just like this one from 6 months ago. And a couple of days ago, I helped Nicholas Negroponte set up the Media Lab, actually a little more than 30 years ago. In typical university fashion, they decided to date their 30th anniversary from the time that their building got built. And in fact, the Media Lab had been around before the building. And this, in fact, is their second building. They have two buildings there now. And thinking about where did the Media Lab come from? Well, in many ways, it actually, although Nicholas was a driving force behind it, philosophically, he and also myself were very influenced by these two guys. Papert's name may be familiar to people. I hope Marvin Minsky's is. He was one of the main guys to bring forth the idea of artificial intelligence, written some of the best things still about it. Here's a book that everybody should read called Society of Mind. Still the best book about trying to find an architecture for psychology. If you think about what psychology is about, you can imagine trying to think of it as a structure and a process. That's what this book is about. And Papert's most famous book is called Mindstorms, which is about children and computing. Both of these guys were on a higher plane, in my opinion. And so I decided to actually give my short talk there on these two guys. And in trying to characterize what they were like, I came up with three things. First was that these guys could see that the present, what we live in right now, is not necessarily normal, even though we kind of think about the world around us as being normal. They could see, well, it's not normal, it's just an arbitrary thing, could have been different. They could see the implications of fundamental stuff, meaning they were not distracted by what's right in front of them. most people are. Some people use an iPhone or people use a computer. They tend to be extremely distracted by what those things do. It's very hard for them to think about what a computer actually is. These guys had no such problems. And they also dealt with universally important issues. And let's face it, in our daily lives, we spend most of the time not dealing with universally important issues. First, we spend most of our time dealing with our issues, which I claim are not generally universally important. And the issues that we do deal with larger tend not to be universally important issues either, but not so these two guys. So I thought, well, I won't give the talk that I gave at the Media Lab. That is also online now, but I thought these three ideas could make a foundation for this talk. So I'll try and talk a little bit about the tyranny of the present, why normal is a really bad idea, and I'll try and talk about ways of getting beyond appearance, which is kind of one of the major things you have to do in the design world, and maybe say a few words about universally important issues. So this is a metaphor, visual metaphor from the 19th century. It's actually looking pretty good here in the 21st century. Is kind of an erosion model of memory. So in this metaphor, the idea was rain comes down, randomly disturbs some earth, a little channel is formed. That channel happens to be a little bit more efficient at rooting water around, because water can run into it, and things start happening and things start happening, and pretty soon you get one of these. Just from that little thing, and if you started it off again, you'd get a different one, and so forth, and you can get a big one like the Grand Canyon, if you've ever been there. If you're down on the bottom, you can barely see the top. You can imagine being born in the bottom and never being anywhere else. You might not even have the idea of climbing out, because it's tough climbing up those walls, and you probably wouldn't even see that it's pink, because that is the predominant color, and our nervous systems are set up to normalize out anything that's constant in our environment, basically becomes invisible. And if you live down there, that would be normal. You tend to see things that are deviations from that, and like most human beings, you might think of it as just reality. This is just the way it is. My brain is set up by nature to cope with the environment that I'm in. I'm going to spend my energies staying alive and coping and so forth. The idea of climbing out, I might not have the energy for that. And of course, we can think of there being a little essence of pink that channel, perhaps. So, another channel might have a little essence of green. And you get a green world. Same deal. You grow up in this one. So complete. Everything's green. The water seems to be green. And if you happen to somehow get out of that pink world and into the green world, then all of a sudden you would realize, wow, whatever this thing is, the other thing isn't. And all of a sudden you would start seeing color, because you've seen a different color and it's different from your nervous system. Getting used to this, you can go back in the other world and see it has a pink color. And of course, culturally, science is one of these green gullies. Really, really different when we finally climbed into that. I was very lucky, completely by accident, I happened to fall into a green gully when I was in my mid-20s, and that was the research projects organized by ARPA before the D. They were engaged in trying to use computers not for just calculating things, but computers as a way of intellectually amplifying human beings. That was such a difference in the way I thought about computers. I've been a programmer on supercomputers at the National Center for Atmospheric Research. I was shocked because I programmed for 5 years. I was actually not a great programmer, medium level programmer, but I could do a lot of things. And this whole way of looking at computers, this is a perfect example of Sam's quote of mine, which is accurate, is that point of view or perspective or context is worth 80 IQ points. The way these people were thinking about computers was at a completely different level. It was a different world. So this world metaphor is actually pretty good. And once you've seen two of these, you start thinking about, there must be more of them. Right? So you can imagine that if you went to a good university, the good university's job would be to get you to see a different color than the one you brought in there. You might come in with your own goals. You're trying to get from A to B. But if you go to a good university, they wind you up at C, which you never even knew about. That happens less and less now because universities are basically selling degrees, and they unfortunately let the students choose what they're doing as though they're vocational training centers. Think about that. What is the probability that a high school kid is going to have any idea about what they should learn in university? Not most of them. So the present, in many ways, is the least important time we live in. But it's so distracting. And it only has access to a tiny bit of the past that led to it. That's what we tend to remember if we remember the past at all. And of course, the pop culture doesn't remember the past. And generally what that means is our perception of the future is just a little increment. We even have this famous word in Silicon Valley and in America now, a word that has been beaten to death called innovation. But innovation, in the original definition of it in Silicon Valley by Regis McKenna, was taking an idea that already exists into the marketplace. And for instance, he said, invention is, of course, also dependent on things that came before, but the jump is bigger. Xerox PARC is an invention center, he said, and Apple is an innovation center. Coping. If you think about the number of genes we have, the way our brains are shaped, the fact that we're not just primates but also mammals, we're not just mammals but also animals, a lot of our genetic material, and especially that having to do with behavior, has to do with coping with worlds that we have a very difficult time understanding and planning. The fact that we're here means that we've been really good copers for the most part. The problem is that coping instinct really works against our ability to come up with valuable new things. One of the things that shocked me about the ARPA experience was I realized after seeing the way ARPA went about computing that as a programmer, somebody else chose the computer I was programming on, somebody chose the programming language I was supposed to program in, somebody chose the problem I was supposed to program in, somebody chose this and somebody chose that. And my job was to deal with all of these external constraints and come up with a program within there. And I didn't realize I hadn't been doing much thinking. until I got into a group that was doing thinking. And the cool thing is if we could do something about the present, we could have access to much more in the past. So one of the ways of thinking about the present is if we can just imagine that we're trapped in this erosion gully, that most of the time we act as though it's actual reality rather than just a gully we happen to find ourselves in. We might be able to disappear it. And if we can disappear it, we might be able to use our nose. We actually have noses that work, not as good as dogs' noses. We tend to use our eyes more than any other sensory mechanism. But the nice thing about sense is we can smell things behind us and we can't see things behind us. We can smell layers of things in ways that we can't do with our vision. So we might be able to smell something. And that smell might alert us to other parts of the past. The past might remind us of something we come up with now, a vision, that really has nothing particularly to do with the present. It has only to do with the past and the future. We might get an idea, meaning a real idea. Remember, most ideas are mediocre down to bad. So it's not having an idea that's the problem that we want to aim at. It's actually having one that is at all worthwhile. And one of the ways to do that is this disappearing of the present. And here's another little preliminary metaphor. Our language has nouns. Nouns are about things more than anything, Indo-European languages. And so is an idea a thing, like it's made out of matter, or is it made out of light? Is it made out of radiation? If it's made out of matter, it doesn't interpenetrate. If it's made out of radiation, we can have a whole bunch of ideas up at the same time. There's no conflict. You can even see interactions between them. We don't have to resolve them. They're not competing. It's not like musical chairs. An idea isn't competing for a chair. So in this talk, I'm going to treat ideas as though they're light processes, verbs, not nouns. We like t-shirts in Silicon Valley, so here's our design t-shirt. Should be all wearing this right now. Now here's an abstraction of a place we could live, looking at it from the top. And so we're here at A, and we can look out like that, and there's where we want to get to at B, and straight line, and let's go for it. And the problem is there are more dimensions in the world than we think, so we might actually have this process, but we can explore. So if we're willing to go away from our goal, we might find a route. And if we find the route, we can make a superhighway. And if we are willing to abandon two dimensions, we can think of flying over there. And once we've abandoned the world that we live in, we could actually find a blue world rather than the pink world. And we wind up at this proverbial sea. So this is a quick visual metaphor of a bunch of ideas. That problem solving is probably the weakest thing we can do when we're trying to make progress. Problem finding is more important, and finding the things that we might use to deal with what our actual problem is are even more important. In this metaphor, we really wanted to get to sea, but we didn't know it. We got there because we were willing to do some extra work. First, we were willing to go away from our goal. This is a good one for companies that have a hard time with that. Hey, boss, we have to go away from our goal to make progress. What? until after the board of directors. Here's another way of looking at it. You're working on a project. Here's your progress curve. It starts petering out. But all the time you're learning, this is especially for people who write computer programs. So just when things start petering out, your learning gets you to the idea you wish you'd been able to put earlier in there. If I could only go back and put this idea in, things would be so much better. I could start there and get way beyond where the red guy is going. And the problem is I have to spend some money, have to back up, have to convince people I want to change my mind because I've got a better idea. But if you can do this, the big bucks happen by being able to incorporate learning curves into the process. So one way of thinking about it is you're doing research only so long as you can change your mind. And you're making a decision. Could be a good decision, because you don't want to change your mind over and over and over again. But the switch from actually doing something like research to engineering has to do with the willingness to incorporate the learning that you're doing in the current thing that you're working on. And you can imagine that this red guy could be designed to deal with this idea. I can tell you, and I'm sure you realize this, that most software in the world is absolutely not designed to deal with even the reformulation that happens downstream after the software is successfully deployed. 85% of the cost of business software comes after the software has been successfully deployed. And that cost, those legacy costs, are partly because of the intractability of the way the first thing was done. The only goal of the first thing was to get it done. Leave it till later for the reformulations as the conditions change in the outside world. So this is crazy. But it actually does cost a little more money spent here. Corporations have a big problem with this because they don't get any tax credits for thinking ahead. Right? Zero. Hey, 10 years from now, I just saved you $15 billion. Yeah, but what about next quarter? Okay, and just as a little idea about thinking about important things, we're actually embedded in something that is too complicated for our minds to deal with all at once. And this is an abstraction of it. We're in a physical world, world of nature. These are a whole bunch of people here. We're in a system of human society. This is a self-portrait of the internet. It represents the system of technology we're in. These systems intertwine with each other. And we ourselves are hundreds and hundreds of different systems, both physical and mental. So in order to do anything, in order not to be immobile, we have to shut these out most of the time. And in fact, human beings have successfully even avoided thinking about these things for most of our existence on the planet, because we have our tiny little brains, very similar to the ones, as far as we know, of 100,000 or more years ago. And these brains operate not really by thinking, but by believing. So the simplest way to think of that pink stuff, our beliefs, the technical term for it is bullshit. So we have 3 pounds of bullshit in between our ears, constantly generating stuff that it claims are reality. But in fact, now we have a little more perspective. It's not reality at all. It's just a story, a whole bunch of stories. Many of those stories that we cling to are ones that we like for one reason or another. And so thinking is not remembering, even though most school emphasizes remembering. Thinking is not being logical, even though rationality has been sought after by the Greeks by the 18th century. Be rational. No. Logical thinking is relative to a context. It's relative to one of those pink gullies. If you have a bad gully, you can be rational up the gazoo and come to terrible conclusions, even though they're completely logical. So thinking is something more like a relationship between the, or a negotiation between what we can represent inside of our heads and with our various representation system and the stuff that's out there, the stuff that's too complex for us to deal with directly. And it's a dynamic negotiation. So this is a tough one to get into American schools. It's a tough one for politicians to understand because they want truth or they want a lie. But in fact, that was given up hundreds of years ago when science got invented. Science is about thousands of different variations of false, some of which are incredibly important and will save our lives. Okay, so here's a couple of ideas to think about. So this is a ledger. I put it inside the canyon there so we won't forget that we're in a context of some hundreds of years ago when double entry bookkeeping was invented. It's actually a pretty good invention. Problem is we're still doing it. When mechanical things came along, our little brains said we must apply this somehow. Application. You guys heard that word? We must have applications. And so the natural thing we do is to say, okay, I want to take this thing that I'm doing right now and I want to mechanize it. And if I do that, I'll get a punch card machines. And if I mechanize that, this is a 1401, my first computer back in 1961 or so. What programs did we write back then? Those programs that we wrote back then, we're not just simulating the ledger, but they were simulating these things. Because there were all of these flowcharts that I was in the Air Force, all these flowcharts that the Air Force had about how you needed cards through these machines. And so instead of trying to think about, hey, what are these things actually good for, even in this area that's kind of like accounting, do I really want to look at embalmed figures from the past? Or, yeah, I could use a computer to simulate ahead, but no. And in fact, there have been many layers, and there have been a couple of essays written by people who have found punch card shops in four or five layers of corporate programs, each simulating the previous layer going back to the time of double entry bookkeeping before punch cards. So we do this all the time. This is a part of the coping mechanism. This is how to avoid thinking, how to avoid having to come up with an idea, how to avoid having to convince somebody. If you do have, let's just automate the same old thing. So Thoreau here, pronounced Thoreau in New England, where I grew up, Thoreau said we become the tools of our tools. And so these tools that we make form gullies. It's not just this thing that forms the gully, but every time we do something, we make ourselves a canyon to be trapped in. Or we can come back out. So instead of using the word application, we could use the word implication. What is the implication of these gears? What does that mean? And all of a sudden, you don't get an automatic plus there. What is the combination? And because you don't get an automatic plus there, you get a question mark there, and you get a question mark there, and all of a sudden, you've set up the groundwork for being able to do some thinking. But that didn't happen. So, in those days, three different kinds of programming were done on this 1401. I don't want to wax poetical about the 1401 because it was an incredible kludge of a computer, but the most interesting thing about it is it did all of this work with only 8K bytes. And the bytes were not 8 bits long, they were only 6 bit long. So the first thing is assembly code, which most of the programs are written in. COBOL, yes, COBOL could be compiled on 1401. And RPG. Anybody here recognize RPG? It's still around. Yeah, you should recognize it because a kind of RPG was the initial software for this company that we're sitting in the middle of. That was what Hasso and the others did in the 80s to try and bring some sort of combination of COBOL and what you could do with RPG, reports program generator, to ordinary end users in companies. And it turned out the best of these three, if you were good, was the assembly code because it was an extensible language. It was actually one of the best Mac OS assemblers ever done. And you could make up new language forms, including forms of things that we would call something like object-oriented programming today. You could make up abstractions. And you could make up programs that were very, very powerful, very clear, and understandable. But it was not easy for most programmers to learn how to program this way. You had to do too much design. COBOL was what it was, and at its best, it was gistable. For a simple program, you could look at COBOL and sort of see what it did. For complicated programs, it dropped you off a cliff. And RPG wasn't exactly like spreadsheets. It was a little bit nicer than spreadsheets. It had spreadsheet properties in it. And if you were trying to do a certain class of reports, which most people were doing, it abstracted those, and it was the simplest of the three to get something going and out, but it was the most inflexible. So those three alternatives are still available today in various forms. If you have to go over here and you're not expert, everybody is in trouble. Because this is where the kludge here, you wind up with piles and piles of stuff which eventually gets in trouble. And over here, you wind up restricting what the people in the business can actually do in order to make progress. So it'd be great to try and learn from this. So the first Turing Award winner, Alan Perlis, said a programming language is low level when its programs require attention to the irrelevant. Can anybody name a good high level language? Well, there are a couple, but not for business, I'm afraid. If you pick a small enough area, like even Haskell, could be considered high level. But the area of application is so small that it's hard to think of it as being serious. TOBE, anybody here look at TOBE periodically? Okay, so TOBE, T-I-O-B-E, keeps a running total of the usage of different programming languages in business. This is one from a few weeks ago, September. So the top four, Java, C, C++, and C Sharp, constitute 50% of the use, right? This is not news to anybody. Y2K, why are they even being used? Well, because their abstractions are not high enough, because they're quote unquote universal, people are willing to grind their way through making intractable programs to get things done. So this is really amazing, because the architecture of these languages all go back before 1970. So we're talking about 60s level, not even the most interesting languages of the 60s, although C++ is rather like what Simula was back then. Assembly language is in there at number 11. That really surprised me. I wouldn't have guessed that. I wasn't surprised to see COBOL was still in the top 20. So some years ago, I did some consulting for State Farm. It's the largest insurance company in America. And I found out that amongst their 25,000 programmers, most of which, by the way, are in an entire town in the middle of Indiana. Just incredible. It's like a college, except it's full of hackers. 2,000 COBOL programmers out of those 25, and 2,000 PL1 programmers. And all of the, both COBOL and the PL1 are running on emulators of machines that they used to run on back a long time ago. Ruby has some features that seem somewhat familiar. It would have been useful back in the late 60s. Now, a different way of looking at this, and you could talk to Dan Ingalls about some of the stuff he's been doing. One of the ways to look at this is, well, Moore's Law has not made us nicer CPUs, to put it mildly. It's really ugly, but they sure are fast. Even the memory architectures, which are really terrible, are a lot faster than they used to be. These are horrible, but when you're dealing with a horrible language, you should just treat it like assembly code. Not fit for a human being to write one line of, but you don't have to write a generator, climb out of the pit here. It's amazing how little this is actually done. So we can apply some of this rhetoric I'm dumping on you here. Let's take a phrase from today, big data. Everybody heard that? Put it in the canyon. Big data, where is it? Was data actually a good idea? Let's see, if I send a data structure from here over to Europe, what do I have to send with it? Well, I might have to send a manual, might have to send some code. Don't get to put it in the data structure because that's what the relational database is about. Might have to send a programmer. Could have a tag like employee, which has a different meaning in the US than it does in Germany. So somebody else is going to have to figure this out. I mean, to me, data looks like one of the worst ideas anybody ever had. Just, we've never gotten rid of it because it was very hard for punch cards to be active. So they were good for putting numbers and letters on. And things were small enough so there, when there was an argument about what a tag meant, people could resolve it. But that is not the world we live in today. So I claim, yeah, big data, forget about it. Don't even use it. SAP should not use it. They shouldn't be trying to market HANA on that basis. Because what we need is not big data, but big meaning. And big meaning is something completely different. Down at the bottom, there are going to be bits. But big meaning is about process. It's about structures that parallel the kinds of ways humans think about things. It has a way of thinking about employee that is actually a process. It's crazy to think about data today. Okay, so the game of what is it? Look at these things, they're all full of mechanical type things. People thought of gears. This is like a watch. It's got all of these interconnected. If I take this thing that's like a gear, here's a program here, and I take this thing that's like, I get them so that they work together like the gears meshing, then I put a bunch of these things together, I'll get something that's more than the sum of the parts. True enough. But it doesn't scale. You can only make something out of about 1,000 gears before they seize up. And the reason is you just can't make the tolerances well enough. You can't make the error correction mechanically well enough. It's not a good metaphor once you start scaling. So another thing to look at is, what does scale? Well, biology scales. We have trillions of cells in our body. Who knows here how many cells we have in our body? Anybody got an idea? Okay, I'll give you the answer and then ask another question. We have about 100 trillion cells. Okay? 100 trillion. Not billion, but trillion. Okay, how many of those cells have our own DNA?
10%.
How many? No.
10%.
Only 10%. We have 10 trillion cells that have our DNA. 90% of the cells in our body, the living cells in our body, are microorganisms, slime. 90 trillion cells. It's a glob about, because they're smaller than our cells. More than 22,000 species have been counted so far and still counting. Biologists do not know what most of them do. Some of them are trying to eat us. As you'd soon find out if you drop dead. Some of these would just consume you. Other ones are fighting off those. So we are an extremely complex system, not just made out of our own DNA, but we have both parasites and symbiotes as part of this enormous complexity. So the stability that we have is dynamical. And vast, faster than anything you could ever imagine with a gear. Computing hasn't really recognized this, except from that green gully that I showed. Because what's the message of gears to biology? Well, it's something like the internet. No center of control, loose coupling, not tight coupling, late bound, extremely scalable. You can change out all the atoms and the bits without stopping it. If you think about it, it is unlike almost any software system that has ever been done. Because software people just completely missed. The internet works so well, most computer people don't even think of it as technology. Think of it, it's something that's scaled by 10 orders of magnitude without breaking. So programming has failed to take our best example and heed it. Let's shoot everyone, really. Why hire people who cannot even understand the implications of their own field? So gears don't themselves, when they expand, you get a system of a watch that's like chemistry, doesn't scale into more and more chemistry, you wind up with biology. So there are these huge qualitative changes. And learning how to code, which is a fad right now, it's like the last thing you want to learn about computing. Yeah, you got to learn it, but computing is about systems. It's not about algorithms. It's not about the if statement. It's about powerful ideas that are made into descriptions that computers can interpret. That is what it's about. Shouldn't hire anybody who doesn't get that. Right? So you have these huge breaks here. Another direction, go back to the same diagram, yeah, we think it's like gears. What else could it be like? Well, it's kind of like a book that can read and write itself. Think about it. It's got an enormous amount of content written in arbitrary languages. But the computer can write its own book, can read its own book. That's incredible. Think about what a book is. Now you start seeing the computer, it's media. It's great to look at it like the internet, we better. But we also need to think about it as what media is about. So from gears to writing, and what is the message from gears to writing? The message from gears to writing is that everybody needs to learn how to read and write. And for the same kinds of reasons. It's not to get a job. It's because it raises the level of enlightenment and the kinds of ideas that can be represented. Think of what the change in business would be if end users in business were really computer literate. And I don't mean being able to write a few lines of JavaScript or writing a few lines of SQL. I mean that there is a language that has many of the same kinds of features that we associate with the languages that we read and write. And that language is read and writable also, but it's about describing processes, the kinds of processes and visualizations that we want. So again, programming has failed to heed computing's own best destiny, because programming has generally not been aimed at the end users at all. So I'm going to do a little quick exercise here. How many people here still remember who Wayne Gretzky is? Oh, good. So the greatest hockey player who ever lived by tons. Scored more than twice as many goals as anybody else in history. And he was not a big guy. 5'11", 180 pounds or so. And he didn't like fighting. And they asked him what he said, I have two secrets. One is, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. That's one to think about. He took more shots on goal than anybody else took. The other thing he said is, good hockey players go to where the puck is, and great hockey players go to where the puck is going to be. And what he meant was not tracking the puck and getting over there, but getting to a place on the rink where he could be past the puck so he could shoot a goal. That's what he did. So he thought about it completely differently. He thought about it strategically rather than just tactically. And so the Wayne Gretzky game is another way of getting rid of the present. So the idea is we want to go out 30 years, so far that we don't have to worry about how we're going to get there. And make up sentences like, it would be ridiculous if we didn't have X. And again, using our nose a bit. So I'm just going to take that last example of the image I had in the late 60s of two kids learning about physics by having programmed a game of space war with orbits, 12-year-olds, connected by wireless tablets, stylus, and all that stuff. So that was an image I had in the late 60s, and the reason I took it seriously was if you looked out from the late 60s to the late 90s and took Moore's Law seriously, there was no way we weren't going to have flat screen, laptop, and tablet computers by then. No way! Because the flat screens were already around. Moore's Law could count the transistors these things needed. There's no way. 30 years from now, no problem. So it'd be ridiculous if taking that 30 years out, that wasn't going to be an image. No question. But 30 years is so far away. So in this game, first you get a bunch of these. So we should do a couple ourselves here. But here's the game. So you go out there. There's Moore's Law. Yeah, we don't know how to do it, but let's bring it back to 10 to 15 years out. Start thinking about that. What is this version of this inevitable thing? What would it be like 10 to 15 years out? And I'm taking now to be 1971, which is when Xerox PARC was formed. So we're looking now into the mid-80s. Yeah, what could that be? And, well, there's a lot of engineering that has to be done, obviously. But it looked like the real problem here was not so much doing the engineering, but in, if everybody's going to have one of these things, what does it mean to deal with it? In other words, it's a user interface. Once you start thinking about personal computing and take it seriously, it's really all about user interface. Because it doesn't matter what the computer can do if it can't be learned by billions of people. And how do you do that? Well, what's cool about Moore's Law is you can pay money, still. You can get a computer with the same power as this guy and bring it just a few years away. It's just money. Remember, because Moore's Law is helping us not just in size, but it's helping us in what the cost of these things are. So if you're willing to spend, say, like we did at PARC, spend $22,000 here, which is about $85,000 today, spend $22,000 for something that would do what that would do in the 80s, then all of a sudden, you could start computing in the 80s and the 70s, and now you might have time enough to invent the user interfaces that are needed. And what you need is a genius. Here's Chuck Thacker. Geniuses are great because they don't do things the way ordinary people do. So you get a genius to do this. And then you get another genius over here, Dan Ingalls, who knows how to make a really complicated new kind of system design work, be a major designer of it. And all of a sudden, you can come up with a user interface that everybody's using today. And by the way, most of the applications. Right back then. Now, of course, it's not a personal computer experiment unless you have a bunch of them. So we had a little production line. We made about 2,000 of these machines. Xerox squealed. But how can you do an experiment in personal computing if you don't have personal computers? And of course, the Ethernet was invented to hook them together and so on and so forth. And kind of the zeitgeist, I will admit to having a few ideas in here as well. And there were two things about doing things this way that were important. One was, this thing was like having a personal supercomputer in those days. It was much faster than time sharing. And so you could do a gazillion experiments without even optimizing. Dan will remember, we used to go out and drink, we drank a lot of beer at PARC. And we'd go out and have a couple of pitchers of beer for lunch and come back and just write user interface experiments all afternoon long. A lot of times we wouldn't even bother saving the programs because this machine was so fast that we could just try things out, not worrying about optimization. And then the other thing we could do is if we are going to optimize the thing, because remember this computer is like this thing in the future, then we can make far future apps. So for instance, Microsoft Word was actually done in 1973 and 1974. At Xerox PARC with the same features as when it came out in the 80s. So you can do those two things. Now most people don't do either one of those two things. Because the stupidest thing you can ever see in a design center or research center is people dicking around with laptops. Why? Because you're computing in the past. It takes time to do software. and you have to do experiments. You have to compute in the future. The company has to realize. In fact, if you want to do serious applications, realize that applications take some years to do. Why not do the applications first on a supercomputer so you can get the user interface from it? Think about it. So the problem here is people being reasonable shut themselves off from having any reasonable idea at all. So that's how you get the puck into the goal, is by doing this kind of non-standard process, but thinking about what the implications of spending money now are going to get you later on. Okay, so now we come into our world of today, which is a consumer world in many, many ways, and a lot of the consumer ideas have gone into business. So here is a consumer product, a bicycle. You can see it sort of is the trappings. It's very fancy, designed to appeal to parents. It has training wheels so the kid won't get hurt. Training wheels are like frets on a violin. They're actually anti-learning. And I'm not making this up. This is pretty funny. There are adult societies all over the United States who have rallies and races on training wheel bikes. Some people don't learn to ride wheel bikes. A lot of people do, but I found this incredible. Just put it down to anthropology 101. You're comfortable with what you learn early. Now, how do you learn a bike? Anybody know what the best way to learn a bike? So you get the kid a low bike, doesn't have any pedals, because pedals are irrelevant to the main thing. What you've got here is the perfect thing, because the kid can scoot along, they can learn how to balance, they can learn how to steer into the turn, and they don't fall down, because they can just stick their feet out, it's that low, and off they go. Took a long time to get these bikes in there. So basic idea is user-friendly often isn't. So marketing are out after what people want. Educators are out after what people need. And the disconnect here is enormous. So many of the user interfaces that are done these days are actually anti-progress and anti-learning. Is it worth it that learning to read and write is difficult? And I'll leave that as a question for you to think about. Okay, another thing to understand is primates and many mammals can learn how to ride bikes. The reason is that our visual body system has been coordinated for millions of years. It's actually relatively easy to learn things if you're an animal that require balance correlated with what your inner ears tell you, correlated with what your eyes tell you, with what your body has to do. So, principle number one in user interface is you should make use of this, right? Yeah, that's what we did. But the important idea here is we are not monkeys, we're not chimps. The part of us that is different is special. It's what makes us special. And so if you do a user interface that only caters to this and doesn't cater to what's special with us, you're treating a person like a dumb animal. And that is what, for instance, our largest computer company today actually does. This is what the Apple user interface on the iPad and the iPhone actually does. Yeah, it's short. Like, you know, finger painting is good for 2-year-olds and 92-year-olds. But in between, we use tools. So when the iPad first came out, Steve sent me a copy for my opinion, and I said, Steve, where are you going to store the stylus? And he says, well, people, you know, are going to do things with their fingers. And I said, Steve, you can't do everything you need to do with your fingers. And I know you can buy a stylus, but God damn it, put a place for putting that stylus. Think about what the thing is larger. Turned out not to matter in the marketplace, because most people were only too happy to revert to primate level. That is consumer marketing 101. Because there's no learning curve. Okay. So we're starting to get closer to, I've been going for about just about an hour. Getting closer to questions. Now, I'm jealous because there are a lot of fields that have really good computer-aided design tools. They have good simulators, and now they're starting to hook in fab, like mechanical. Man, can you even make a car? Simulate it. You know whether it's going to bust up or not. You can make a flute. So the message here is ship the design. Now, it turns out this is true in electrical also. You absolutely do not want to fab a chip and then debug it. That is a nightmare. That was realized a long time ago when chips were a lot simpler. No. You want to simulate the shit out of that chip. You want to get it all organized, simulate it six ways from Sunday, and then have it go automatically off to fab like you're sending it off, sending a document off to the printer. Everybody knows that. BioCAD. I used to be a molecular biologist in my misspent youth. You should see the tools these guys have. And a couple of things were done, like Park did word processing and desktop publishing. That's CAD for documents. Turns out the web browser can't do this worth beans, even after 20-some-odd years. So what kind of people are actually programming the web browser? They just don't get it. Most people can't even criticize the web browser, but here's an easy one. Ship the design. CAD for programming. Dan was the main architect of the first really good user interface for doing programming. And again, it's this thing where you want to have a live system. You want to use the system's power on itself. You want to be able to, when you get done, that's it. It's there. It's ready to go. Ship the design. But you go to any university in the country, what do you find? You find undergraduates and graduate students programming in simulated punch cards on a simulated bi-terminal. Does this remind you of a slide I showed before? I mean, this is like outrageous. Think about how stupid this is. This is incredible. And what it means is, yeah, in other words, yeah, like, don't ship it, please. Because they're not, the whole system is some idiotic throwback to the 60s, and it's anti-personal computing. So, you know, as an old fogey, I get to complain a bit. My main complaint about our field, it isn't really a field. Our field doesn't know who made the field. Most people, if you ask who's Doug Engelbart, they'll say something, well, didn't you have something to do with the mouse? And it turns out if you type in G-E-L-B-A-R-T into Google, in the first five hits, you'll get Engelbart's website that have the 75 papers he wrote, and you'll get a pointer into the big demo he did in 1968. And you spent even 15 minutes, you'd realize that this guy had a conception of computing that is larger than most companies have today. That personally frosts all of us, because computing was more difficult back then. that a lot of effort was put in making an internet and making personal computing, partly for the express purpose of putting a person a couple of mouse clicks away from satisfying their curiosity. The thing we were disheartened to find out over the last 40 years is most people are not curious. They're just pragmatizing their way through life. And so computers are probably have the least perspective on their field of any practitioners, and thus we wind up with something that isn't really a field. It's definitely not like physics or chemistry or biology. It has none of those characteristics. Okay, so maybe this is a good place to just wind it down. Another one of these juxtapositions that for the last 50 or so years, most of the programming we do is dealing with hows. How do we do this? How do we do that? And we specify those hows in many different forms, and the systems that we ship are made out of those forms. But in our minds, we're thinking about what? Like, these were the goals, and what are we trying to do here? This large insurance company I mentioned, I was finding out what is a big insurance program like, and well, part of the problem was for them is that they're unlike there is a national bank, there are federal regulations for banks. There's no national insurance system, no national regulations for insurance systems. So a big insurance company has a different set of laws to deal with in every state. And so one of the requirements, they took me to a room. I said, well, what are the requirements like for one of your systems? They took me to a room that was filled with stuff. And I said, well, how many requirements does this system have? And they said, well, about 156,000. Think about that. A 400-page book has 20,000 lines in it. So if each requirement were one line, think of how many books 153,000 requirements. And on that same first day, they took me to what looked like a data center. It looked like a Google data center. It was many floors of glass house, racks and racks of servers. And so I said, oh yeah, this is, I'm an old timer. I like big iron. This is impressive. And I said, what part of your business does this handle? I said, well, it doesn't handle any of our business. This is how we find out what our systems do. I said, what? And he said, yeah, because there's no necessary connection between the requirements and the programs that get written. Programs have millions and hundreds of millions of lines of code. And we run them on this building, 10-story building, full of equipment that partly simulates all the terminals that are hooked in from all of the, right? So it's a kind of a whole cloud thing. When they want to know what one of their applications will do, like they take one of these requirements, will our code do it? They play it like a video game. They stick it in there and the system either does what it's supposed to. Because there's no connection between the what's and the how's. So you've got constraints, you've got meanings, you have relationships. These are the things that you design things in terms of. If those things stay on paper, like, you can't even debug them. See, the problem with their 153,000 requirements is they can't run those requirements. They have no idea whether they're consistent or not. They're kind of like federal law, right? It's just cubic miles of opinions. And leave it to the lawyers later on to make sense of it. So you can imagine if you were going to do computer-aided design for programmers, that you have a user interface that helps you organize your design. Basically, it's first thing to do is to try and design the thing. In order to design the thing, you have to have something that is actually debuggable. In other words, the design is not just a screen layout. The design actually has function in it. That function can be done relatively simply, but that function has to be used as a check against any optimizations that are done later. So you can imagine there being something like an operating system, something that knows about causality. I'm just looking out now, right? This is a Wayne Gretzky game. And what I've got is something that is the next thing like a compiler, except it's not exactly compiling code, it's actually putting together systems. And maybe a better thing to look at here is programming as co-design. Because if you have a live system that deals with these guys and can use function down here, you're actually making the design as you explore the usability of the system. And all of a sudden, what used to be programming starts becoming something very, very different. Now, I already went through one of these things. It turned out there was a term called coding back when I started, and a term called programming. So a programmer actually wrote flowcharts. That was the higher level language used back then. These flowcharts would work on any computer. And what a coder was a human compiler for those flowcharts. The coder's job is to turn those flowcharts into the machine code.